Centre at 5. Crowds of people are protesting minutes away from Grenfell Tower, calling for authorities to take more action following Tuesday night's fire.
Now! We want justice!
They've poured into Kensington Town Hall, where people have also been heard chanting "Not 17." That was the number police previously said were known to have died. Some residents are concerned the actual figure hasn't been revealed for political reasons. At least 30 people are now known to have died in the disaster, but officials have warned that's still likely to rise. Earlier, the Queen and Prince William visited a relief centre close to the 24-storey building. John Wilson, the Bishop of Westminster, has been comforting some of the survivors.
I met a little girl and she just said to me, "My house has burnt down and I'm having to live in a hotel." And she had with her a little suitcase, and all her friends in the class had brought a toy from home because she'd nothing.
Police say there's no suggestion the blaze was started deliberately. A man's been questioned by counter-terrorism officers after appearing to reach for a knife close to Parliament. The suspect was tasered before being arrested. A new inquest into the death of a soldier at Deep Cump Barracks will look into whether he was hounded by bullying and harassment. 20-year-old Sean Benton died at the Surrey base in 2005 after being told he was being discharged from the army. His family wants a jury to decide on the case after an initial finding of suicide. It's understood Cristiano Ronaldo wants to leave Real Madrid because he no longer wants to play in Spain. The former Manchester United winger was recently accused of avoiding £13 million in tax, a charge he denies. And Amazon is buying the supermarket chain Whole Foods in an all-cash deal worth just under £11 billion. The store will continue to operate under the same name. That's the latest. I'm Kieran Corr.
BCFM is special.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM. 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Mark Weston. Also, Labour councillor for Eastville, Fari Threlfall. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, it's 50 years since the Six-Day War, which was based on a lie that Israel was being attacked. It illegally trebled the size of the Israeli state. 100 years since the original Balfour Declaration, which promised Zionists a homeland in the British Empire. Little analysis of what has become an open wound in the Middle East with religious fundamentalism, Zionist as well as Muslim, at the heart of it. Tonight we hear about abuses of the Old Testament Bible, Moses' Exodus 3,500 years ago, by Zionist fundamentalists to justify apartheid and land grabs, from the author of a book, Christian Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon. He's a Church of England vicar, Stephen Sizer. In February 2016, last year, that is, a media furore broke out. He was asked by the Bishop of Guildford to give up his right to speak publicly about the Middle East affairs, and also he wasn't allowed to use social media. We find out tonight that he wasn't actually banned, as the newspapers said he was. In his first interview about the furore since he retired from his parish in Surrey earlier this year. Plus, is Mad Dog Mattis at it again? In 2004, he was caught using white phosphorus chemical weapons on civilians in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Last week, according to the UN and Human Rights Watch, the US Air Force was using this devastating and illegal chemical agent against civilians in its bombs again in Iraq and in Raqqa, Syria too. Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's warm two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. weather.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius, mainly dry this weekend. Highs of 27 degrees Celsius, sunny and very warm. Next week, highs again, 27 through the week. Plenty of sunshine, cooling off slowly as the week progresses. Next weekend, the 24th and 25th of June, highs back down to a little bit more normal, 21 degrees Celsius. Sunny spells and a few showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council and Councillor for Henbury and Brentry, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you for having me.
And also Labour Councillor Freesfield, Vari Threlfall.
Good evening.
First of all, you, Vari, can you just give us your impression of what's been going on in London with the Grenfell Tower? It's pretty horrific, and I suppose what's going to be in most people's minds listening is, could the same sort of thing happen again here in Bristol?
I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking, the situation going on, particularly because, as we're finding out, it was something that could be prevented. We have recently, as a city council, written out to all of the tenants. Councillor Paul Smith has done, in terms of our 59 high-rise properties in Bristol, and to reassure people that the cladding that they use in the London Tower is not actually a material that we use here, and also to reassure them that we do regular tests of fire alarms, and that also we've got a process of ensuring that the fire doors and various other fire safety measures are up to date. So it's quite positive, actually, that Paul Smith and the team within the City Council did release a statement about this in Bristol and the mitigations that we've been going. And we've seen, actually, in 2014, when we had a fire in a high-rise block, Carolina House, which unfortunately did end in a death of the vulnerable resident that lived there, it did prevent the spread of that fire throughout the tower. The fire mitigations did work. In terms of sprinklers, I know there's been a lot of conversations about sprinklers in towers. We've just finished a programme where we've put in sprinklers into all the bin stores within the tower blocks. But I think in London, there is a lot of anger. It's quite justified. I mean, over the last few years, tenants have raised their voices and have expressed concern about the fire safety measures, and it is absolutely heartbreaking it's ended in such a tragedy.
Mark Weston, it's a little bit more than that, isn't it? Because there was attempts by Kensington and Chelsea Council solicitors to actually shut people up, you know, sending them threatening legal letters and things like that, whilst they were warning, saying basically, look, we're at risk of fire here, we have to live with this.
I mean, I confess I haven't seen those letters, but I would echo an awful lot of what Vari's just said. It's heartbreaking, and it's exceedingly unpleasant viewing, and I don't even live there. I mean, the people there just... It's a living nightmare, and it's such so bad, I think, because so much of it seems preventable. I mean, we had the first warnings in 1999, I think, was the first release, and there's been warnings ever since. And the residents last year were saying that we're out further warnings, and it all just seems so sad. I mean, I am to an extent here in Bristol. It looks like the cladding, and I would echo what's been said. It looks like it's safe and it works. It contains the fire effectively, because it seems to be containment that just failed so utterly in the Grenfell Tower in London. And it's got heartbreaking results. I mean, with the death toll now, they're confirming 30, but we know that's going to go up.
I think they're saying 70 now, actually.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised if that goes up a little bit higher, if I'm honest.
And I think, you know, when we're talking about things like this, the people really we should be listening to are those that suffered directly themselves. There were a group on the fourth floor of Grenfell Tower that managed to get out. They were some of the first families to get out, because it does seem that that was where the fire started. And here is an account by a guy called Mahad, who popped up the Wednesday morning of the attack on the BBC One special that was being done, conducted by Victoria Derbyshire. So let's have a little listen to his account of how he first heard out about the fire, and then how he managed to escape, and what he gathered outside talking to other residents immediately after the alarm began to be raised, although, of course, not a proper alarm.
It was just before 1 a.m. My wife and I were in the sitting room. The kids were sleeping, obviously.
You have two young children.
Two young children, 2-year-old and a 3-year-old, boy and a girl. There was a sudden bang at the door just before 1, and when I went to investigate, I was greeted by smoke and some dark cloud.
So the bang at the door was someone knocking on your door to wake you up?
Alert us, and once I opened the door, there was so much smoke, I shut the door right back. There was no one standing there because obviously the person attempted to knock further more doors. At which point I closed the door, got some towels, wet them, alerted my wife down the corridor screaming, "There's fire, fire, get out." So wetted up some towels, went into the kids' room, wrapped them in the towels over their heads, proceeded to exit the premises. Where it was, it's so dark and so much smoke was there. There was people running down the stairs. It was people, some people even had some luggages. It was just so much confusion. There was no sound of alarm or bells whatsoever. We only heard the alarm after 1:30 a.m. So this was like an actual fail in terms of safety measures that should have been in place to alert the residents.
So no fire alarm, but someone banging on your door. You get your wife, you get your two young children.
I knocked also on a neighbour that was on my right-hand side, where I gave a good two kicks. Just kept running because at this point, I didn't want the kids to be inhaling any more smoke. This is so dangerous. I didn't want to collapse in the middle of it. The whole fire started off on the fourth floor, and I live on the fourth floor.
How do you know that?
Because once we were going down the stairs and we came to the ground floor, exiting the premises, I was confronted by my neighbour who lives at number 16. He said, "Look, are you okay?" He was, you know, checking me and the kids. I said, "You alright? You okay? Is your wife out?" Because I do know that his wife also resides in the premises. So I did show concern and I said, "You know, where is your wife? I haven't seen her." You know, he said, "It was my house. My fridge exploded."
The guy who lives next door to you on the fourth floor said his fridge exploded.
He said his fridge exploded. At which point, the fire brigade were well aware of it. The supervising senior fire brigades were also there when they took some statement or some sort of understanding from him and what was going on. We've seen fire brigade, we've seen in emergency services, we see it as it can be tackled. We see it as half this building will not be affected. We see it as they can probably swing this in and fire engines around, but there were bollards. There's bollards that are blocking off the fire brigades from coming into the green and then parking themselves in the, you know, convenient. There were hosts everywhere. Fire brigade were doing their best.
Yeah.
They were gathering information and intelligence from the residents who came out as to where the incident and the fire was taking place, what they know so far. So the residents were giving as much information to the fire services, but is also there was a sense of hesitation from the fire brigade because they weren't willing to tackle this. It was not tackled straight away in the sense this hose and the fire brigade, the activity started well late into, say, 2 o'clock, maybe even 3.
Maybe even 3, he's saying there. I mean, it does sound, Martin Summers, it does sound as if the fire brigade were caught unawares here because they put out a fire, some guy's fridge exploding in his flat. They went outside. They'd expected that to be it. And what they realised is that because the fridge was next to a window, it had actually caught the window and part of the outside of the building alight, and the fire brigade were caught unawares.
Well, this cladding seems to be a crucial question, doesn't it? It does seem odd to put non-flame resistant cladding on a building, and that'll have to be looked at, won't it? I mean, obviously it's easy to jump to conclusions in the immediate aftermath of an incident like this. I think everybody's got to be calm, let's have a look at it properly, and then if blame has to be apportioned, and of course David Lammy, the Labour MP for Tottenham, is calling for prosecutions if it seems that people have been negligent.
Well, and the Times is saying that the US has banned this type of cladding and pointing out that it is a little bit cheaper than the fireproof cladding, but only £5,000 cheaper for the whole building.
Well, that then raises questions why that decision was taken and who took it. I mean, the way in which there's no clear line of responsibility once you've semi-privatised things then leads to decisions being taken, but it's not quite clear who's made them or why.
Well, before we hear again from Mark and Vari, let's have a listen now to a report which was, I think, was Wednesday evening on ITV News. Very quick bit of work by them. This is on News at 10, where Joel Hills looked at these two companies which had done the refurbishment last year on Grenfell Tower. That's Ryden and the subcontractors who did the cladding, Harley Facades.
Ryden Group constructs and maintains buildings. In the past, the company's worked for local authorities all over London and the South East.
Ryden really is dedicated to improving the communities that we work in and making a real difference.
Rydon was paid just under £9 million to upgrade Grenfell Tower. The project appears on the company's website. In a statement, Rydon said the work it did met all required building control, fire regulation and health and safety standards. This morning, one of the company's directors took part in a phone interview on ITV and was repeatedly asked about the cladding that had been installed.
Well, we don't know that there's any direct link between fire and the cladding at this stage. I mean, we have to. I don't want to speculate on anything, and obviously, we have to wait for the outcome of the inquiries. I know there's been a number of eyewitness reports and comments and so on and so forth, but at this stage, we can't. We don't know the start of the fire, the cause of the fire, whatever. And as far as we know, there's no link to the refurbishment works.
It later emerged that although Rydon was the contractor, the cladding work had been outsourced. Harley Facades Limited was paid just over £2.5 million to clad the exterior of the tower block and replace the windows. Details of the Grenfell project were on the company's website first thing this morning, but were later removed. Now, the office has been shut up early, and we were told that no one was available for interview. Tonight, Harley confirmed that although it fitted the aluminium cladding panels, it did not manufacture them. Both Harley and Rydon have pledged to help with any investigation. Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation looks after Grenfell Tower and the council's other properties. A fire at a different tower block 2 years ago led to the London Fire Brigade taking enforcement action against the organisation. The Fire Brigade highlighted a failure to make a suitable and sufficient fire risk assessment, a failure to eliminate or reduce dangerous substances, and a failure to provide and or maintain adequate and clearly signed emergency routes and exits.
I do not run, unsafe services. I'm absolutely shocked by this outcome. Well, what I say is, people are saying lots of things, and that doesn't mean they're true.
Rydon completed the Grenfell Tower refurbishment last June. The council inspected the site and signed the work off, suggesting it felt the contractors had delivered as promised. Joel Hills, News at 10, East Sussex.
Well, I thought it was quite a snappy report there from News at 10. Mark, the main problem here seems to be, and no one can really tell directly how much this contributed to it, but you've got, first of all, you've got Kensington and Chelsea Council owning the building. Mm-hmm. Then you've got, one step beyond them is the Kensington and Chelsea TMO managing the building. One step away from them, you've got Rydon doing the refurbishment contract. And another step away from them, you've got Harley Facades, who are actually putting the facades on. So it's a sort of sub-sub-sub-sub-subcontract. Now, this surely is very difficult for Kensington and Chelsea, who are, after all, the main people who are taking the rents from these properties and should be really managing it. It's a long, long way for them to be able to make sure that a sub-sub-subcontractor is doing what they're supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, in Bristol, we don't have that management company level, but you will have subcontractors doing various bits on it. I know that happened when they refurbished the high-rise in my block. I don't know, and actually, I think I would sort of go with what I think Martin was saying earlier. There's a danger of trying to be wise after the fact, and at the moment, we don't know all the facts. It looks like it is the cladding that was certainly at least part of the problem. There have also been questions raised over smoke alarms. There's a whole different raft of issues to look at. And I'm sort of nervous about trying to jump to any kind of conclusions. There is going to be a full public inquiry, which I think everyone wants, and I want that quickly. But the fire investigators themselves have said this actually could take weeks to go through everything. We're going to have to learn the lessons and learn them fast. I think Sasha Javid today said that, you know, when the fire inspectors are done, if the cladding is the issue, then it's got to come down, even though that could cost billions. And he said that today on Radio 4. I would be tempted to say, don't give in to knee jerk. We're going to need to do a thorough assessment, quick but thorough. But certainly, it's a tragedy, and I'm lost for words, really.
Vari, I suppose you could say that the Daily Mail have decided that there really needs to be immediately some proper investigation of the companies that were doing this work last year, whether or not that turns out to finally be the cause. And there's an article today where they say a company boss has paid £3 million to clad Inferno Tower block, is hiding in his £1 million mansion as homeless residents sleep on the streets, but his wife claims there's nothing to say about the disaster. The cladding on the deadly tower block block was carried out by this Harley Facades for £2.6 million. Raymond and Belinda Bailey are holed up in a grand home in rural East Sussex. Mrs. Bailey has nothing to say. Harley Curtain Wall, reportedly, this is a company he owned, went bust in 2015, owning its creditors £1 million. But it was bought by Harley Facades, Mr. Bailey's other firm, who did the Grenfell project. Its boss, Robert Bond, lives in this £2 million Kent mansion with his Aston Martins and his Porsche. So obviously the Daily Mail have decided that we need to know more about this Harley Facades firm.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have to look into how a lot of these companies operate. But I think I would reiterate the point that, you know, we can't jump to too many conclusions. What I would say is that this public inquiry does need to be public. It does need to involve residents. It does need to involve all those sort of partners that have been raising warnings consistently. And it should also look at... In depth, our building standards. I mean, if this was signed off by the council, yes, there was not necessarily oversight, as there should have been, of the contracts due to all of those different partners being involved. I think it is important that we are looking at the national standards because... at the end of the day, this was signed off by somebody based on those standards. And really interestingly, only a few months ago, Labour did put in actually an amendment which did question some fire safety standards. And I think it is important that we do look at this again, so that this public inquiry is covering companies that are operating in this sector and our current standards, and any changes that do need to be made to public policy need to go through fairly urgently. In terms of the short term, I would support looking at actually how we support those who have lost their homes. You mentioned that, of course, the company director is sitting in his house at the moment. It's a shame that he's not felt able to make a statement about this tragedy. But I think it is important we look at empty homes within the area and ensure that these people get rehoused as quickly as possible.
Now, we've seen crime committed by big companies like HSBC, money laundering, LIBOR by Barclays and others, and yet the people who've been going to jail tend to be quite low level down. I mean, for example, this guy Tom Hayes, who was a trader, who was actually given a book. You know, this is what you do as part of your job, how to fix the LIBOR rate, when he was working at UBS, which is, admittedly, it's a Swiss bank, you know, it's not a British bank. But there have been calls for to look at corporate manslaughter here, where it looks as if potentially people have been hiding behind businesses making quite a lot of money and feeling that they're beyond any possible prosecution, Mark.
Well, I think we've had this discussion before. If a crime's been committed, then they go to jail. I mean, I'm quite robust on that. I don't care whether it's white collar or blue collar or any other kind of colour crime. I just want to know the facts. And at this point, we're sort of acting in a vacuum. And if there is a case where there's been negligence, where there hasn't been proper oversight, where the rules have been broken, inferior products have been used intentionally, knowingly, or whatever, then that is a crime. And you follow and pursue that to full extent of the law. I would go with what Vary says. You have to look at the public safety or fire regulation safety. I would say on the amendment that Labour did publish, that was on private housing. It wouldn't have helped in here. But you have to look at everything in the round. And it's sad, isn't it, that sometimes it takes an absolute tragedy like this in order to focus on areas where there are regulatory weaknesses.
But it's not a vacuum, is it? The Grenfell Action Group said in November last year on their blog, it's our conviction that a serious fire in a tower block or similar high-density residential property is the most likely reason those who wield power at the KCTMO will be found out and brought to justice. We believe that they narrowly averted a major fire disaster at Grenfell Tower in 2013. I mean, effectively, what they're saying is that unless there's a big disaster at this place, no one's going to listen to them, and they're flagging this up 6-8 months ago.
No, I think you're right, and actually I say the first warnings came about 18 years ago. That was when the first warning was fired. And I think too often, actually, this is a mindset in local government and in national government, that it requires something to go wrong before something is fixed. I mean, Vara, you must have it on a minor scale. When you're talking about like road improvements and things like that, when you say, can you put a crossing in here? Well, there'd be no accidents. Yeah, but there will be. You've got to fix it. And there's sort of that mentality, and I think we have to get out of that and be a little more proactive.
Vara, another thing they say on the same blog in November, it's a truly terrifying thought, but the Grenfell Action Group firmly believe that only a catastrophic event will expose the ineptitude and incompetence of our landlord, the KCTMO, and bring an end to the dangerous living conditions, neglect of health and safety legislation that they inflict upon their tenants and leaseholders. Now, I mean, we in Bristol, I think it's about 5 years ago, there was a very close look, mainly pushed by the Lib Dems on the City Council, to actually get Bristol City Council properties transferred over to these TMOs. So I wonder what you make of these warnings. I mean, it just sounds pretty clear that people simply weren't being listened to. They had very legitimate concerns about safety. They're bringing them up. They're being ignored.
This is why when we're looking at this public inquiry, it needs to not just be quite a narrow one looking at the cause of this fire, but actually a lot broader about why these warnings weren't listened to. I mean, what makes this tragedy particularly heartbreaking is the fact that these things have been raised by residents time and time again, including signage. Even things as simple as notifying people what they need to do in case of a fire. There was also something about the fire extinguishers being out of date. I mean, these are multiple failures. This isn't just is not just cladding. This is a number of issues, it's having to look at every single organisation that was being involved in this, and every single organisation that had a duty to respond, including the council.
People are. Would you understand why local people, not just the people that were living there, the people that survived, are not just heartbroken and upset, they're now angry?
Of course they should be angry.
Absolutely, yeah, and I fully support the campaign. So there's been a march, obviously, this afternoon, marching to the town hall, marching for justice, because that's what these individuals need, is that they're incredibly angry, having raised these issues time and time again.
Now, another side to all of this is that we've just had yesterday the announcement by the Prime Minister Theresa May of a public inquiry. But the whole way that public inquiries are conducted is not necessarily satisfactory because of the introduction of, in 2005, June 2005, that's 12 years ago, of just before the 7/7 London bombings, by the way, of something called the Inquiries Act. And there was a film that came out on the internet late that year, which was extremely critical of the legal changes that the Inquiries Act 2005 brought about in the context of those 7/7 London bombings. So let's have a listen to a little excerpt from that now, which explains why this act is so different to the way public inquiries were conducted before 2005.
We are constantly told that the terrorists, especially the CIA-created Islamic group Al-Qaeda, are attacking our way of life and our freedom. But these transparently absurd claims are made only by our government, never by the terrorists themselves, who consistently cite very different and very specific grievances. And ironically, it's not the terrorists attacking our way of life, but our own government. Through the expansion of police powers and stringent anti-terrorist measures being imposed upon Britain, they are using our fear for our safety to restrict our liberty, and they are using their false promises of security to erode our privacy. This is happening now, and it's happening to every person in the UK. You are not somehow exempt from the regulatory provisions of the new police state being brought into this country. The terrorists cannot take away our freedom or change our way of life. Only our own elected leaders can do that. And they are. If you have examined any of the information released about the attacks of the 7th of July, or if you get your news from a reputable source, i.e. one outside of the mainstream media, then you probably are one of those advocating an inquiry into the London bombings. We suggest you stop wasting your time. Why? Because full public inquiries are not full, and they're not public. These terms are used simply to delude us into thinking that the process of an inquiry is intended to uncover the truth about something. This is simply not the case. let's recall the last major public inquiry held in the UK. The Hutton Inquiry, set up to investigate the apparent suicide of Dr. David Kelly, with a side mandate of examining whether the government manipulated intelligence to facilitate the invasion of Iraq. Given that Hutton was appointed by Lord Faulkner, the very man who continues to declare that the Iraq invasion was somehow legal, it is unsurprising that Hutton absolved Blair and his government of blame. The inquiry refuted allegations that the government had lied about information on Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, something that any rational person doing an hour of research can see clearly that they did. And more incredulously, Hutton ruled that Dr. David Kelly committed suicide, despite all the physical and medical evidence that clearly points to him having been murdered. But it gets worse. As if public inquiries were already not pointless enough, a recent piece of legislation now guarantees that they will never be anything other than a charade. On June the 7th, 2005, exactly 1 month before the London bombings, the Inquiries Act became law. Under this new act, any inquiry will be controlled by the relevant government minister, who is empowered to block public scrutiny of state actions. This inexplicable change to the way inquiries are run was openly criticised by the Law Society of England and Amnesty International, who stated that the new act means that any inquiry will be controlled by the executive. Obviously the one thing you don't want from a supposedly unbiased investigation. The Canadian judge Peter Corey stated, "It seems to me that the proposed new act would make a meaningful inquiry impossible. The commissions would be working in an impossible situation. The minister, the actions of whose ministry was to be reviewed by the public inquiry, would have the authority to thwart the efforts of the inquiry at every step. It really creates an intolerable Alice in Wonderland situation." While the chairman of the US Joint Committee on Human Rights, Congressman Chris Smith, declared that the bill pending before the British Parliament should be named the Public Inquiry's Cover-Up Bill.
Well, that's a clip from a film, the YouTube film, Ludicrous Diversion. But the facts, Martin Summers, the facts we can't really argue with, because the fact is that now government ministers are set the boundaries of these public inquiries, and they have quite a big job in actually appointing judges to do them, this sort of thing. Whereas what that seems to do is it you might get an inquiry which is not even-handed when it comes to a possible government culpability.
Well, Judge Peter Corey was involved in an international inquiry into collusion between the British security forces and loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland. And, of course, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland have always called for an inquiry into what went on during the Troubles. And there was actually a very interesting panorama programme about all of this not long ago by Donald McIntyre. But the point is that they say they want an inquiry, but they don't want a British government inquiry, because British government's inquiries since the Inquiries Act of 2005 are no longer independent of the executive. They want an international inquiry. And now, of course, there's politics involved in all of that. But, I mean, the question is, we do need inquiries. The question is, how independent are they? And, of course, the Inquiries Act of 2005 makes them less independent than they were before, to the point where people are not necessarily going to accept the results of those inquiries.
Marx, you have things like the Leveson inquiry, which has happened more recently. A lot of people saying that that's actually come to nothing, pretty much. Is a public inquiry really going to get to the bottom of what happened?
I did wonder how long it would be before we got to conspiracy theory on the show. I'm sorry, I disagree. If the inquiries were so completely reliant on the executive, then Chilcot would have been made to publish years ago. Instead, it went on for year after year after year. Look, public inquiries are set up by the government, and they have I'm hoping there'll be an independent judge. But however you define independent is up to how someone defines their own viewpoint. It should be set up. It should be public. Because I don't think there's any state secrets linked to this one, like you might say there are in the Iraq War or anything else. There's no diplomatic correspondence that might need to be censored on this. This should be a full public inquiry. It should go where the evidence takes it and should have the ability to talk to anyone it wants. I'm not going to poo-poo it now. I think it's a good idea. It should be free roaming. I've got to say, I was a little surprised at the content of the last clip.
But, I mean, the point surely being that it should be independent, run by the judiciary, not by a minister.
Well, at some point, someone's going to have to order an inquiry, and at that point, the minister's going to tell the judiciary to run the inquiry. So the minister's going to be the, at that point you'll be telling me, well, it's going to be up to the minister to determine whether there's an inquiry. There will be an independent judge put in charge of this inquiry and be told to do it. That's how it's going to work.
Vary, are you confident that a public inquiry would be able to get to the bottom of what it was and be able to look at potential government culpability and the regulations involved in this sort of fire?
I think it's a difficult conversation. Certainly, I mean, I'm not personally familiar with the nuances of the previous Act and the current Act, but what I would say is that it is important that we do have impartiality, that we do not have anybody with interests unduly influencing any public inquiry, and that's why I've made the point very strongly that residents' voices do need to be heard within this, that they cannot be shut out of this public inquiry, and I hope that is taken on by the government. And in terms of the recommendations, I mean, I personally, at a lower level, have just gone through an inquiry of sorts, a planning inspectorate hearing surrounding the application for the McDonald's and Fishponds Road.
Oh, yeah,
and we had what I would consider a very fair hearing at the council on making a decision on this decision, which was to reject the application on the basis of the damaging effect it would have on the community. But of course, this has then been overturned by the government, by the planning inspectorate, in favour of McDonald's, which of course is making a lot of residents quite angry about that result and the impact it's going to have in the community. So I think it's really, really challenging. So when we talk about being independent and we're talking about the evidence, I mean, reading that report, it seemed to have a lot of opinion. And we need to shy away from that, particularly in this day and age where we've got a lot of opinion being put forward as fact. So I think it's important that this public inquiry is very, very careful with its recommendations and how that's then taken forward.
But at the same time, I don't think that the inquiry should be shy. Because what you don't want is it someone to say, oh, well, I don't want to tread on any toes, therefore I have to be a bit modest. I think the inquiry should be pretty robust and should come back, and it should be as hard-hitting as it needs to be to make the point.
One of the reports in the Mirror about the Grenfell Tower fire saying that Theresa May's chief of staff sat on a report warning that high-rise blocks like Grenfell Tower were vulnerable to fire. Mm. That is a coroner's report into a previous fire, recommend a review of building regulations 4 years ago. Successive ministers said they were still looking at it. This is really pointing the finger at this chap, Gavin Barwell, who's now the chief of staff for Theresa May.
Well, I think any inquiry on this, I say, will probably go back 20 years on it. I'm not going to predetermine it. I think it should go wherever it takes it. And if it's Gavin Barwell's in the firing line, then he is. But I'm not going to predetermine this because I want the inquiry to go where it needs to go.
Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, it does look as if Gavin Barwell could, if he would have released this report, why did he sit on it? You know, it may well have helped to make sure that
the suspicion has to be that there are kind of vested interests at work here, pulling strings behind the scenes. I think we've got to try and get to the bottom of this, and there will be obviously lots of different points of view, but. Yeah, I mean, there's already going to be speculation about this, isn't there? I mean, one of the things that struck me, this, you know, we've got a big housing divide in Kensington and Chelsea. You know, you've got some of the poorest people in the country.
Yeah, I mean, some of the demands forward today were that people that Kensington and Chelsea are talking about rehousing people, but outside Kensington and
Chelsea.
Well,
I understand that Conservative ministers today said that they're not going to do that and that they will all be rehoused within the borough. And I don't know whether they've cleared that with their bosses, but that's what they said when they were interviewed.
And Vary, also people have been saying, well, this regeneration scheme was actually really about getting us out of here. It wasn't about regeneration, it was about demolition.
And the new MP that was obviously just elected last week by 20 votes is echoing that, that there's been a lot of concern that whilst the council has been expected to make cuts to valuable public services, at the same time it's been spending extensive amounts of money on regenerating tourist areas and actually not putting that money where it needs to be. I think there's also been concerns raised about the fact that this was an aesthetic improvement on the building, not actually something that was for the residents themselves, but actually people who were looking at the building, which I think needs to be questioned, and I'm sure the new MP will do a good job raising that in Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, the waters actually get slightly murky on this, because it's whether the new MP actually was a councillor when they investigated this in 2014, I think she sat on the audit committee that did look at the standards on this. What I would just say is the way... If it was purely for aesthetics, you've got to wonder why they bothered spending any money on it to begin with, especially if it only cost a few thousand extra to give it in a fireproof cladding. So that's one thing that should be looked at. What I would just say on this... when buildings like this are managed, like they're managed here in Bristol, they're funded via the housing revenue account. This is a complexity of local government finance, so half your audience are now already asleep. But that doesn't have a cut to it. That has not been cut. So this isn't an issue about cuts, because actually if you look in Bristol, the amount we spent on maintenance in 2009-10 was £69 million, and now it's £94 million. So this hasn't gone down. I haven't seen Kensington's books, but I imagine it'd be about the same. What I want to know, though, is why so much money was spent, if it was cosmetic, because that is a really daft thing to spend that money on.
Mark, there's been a lot of criticism of Theresa May today by local residents saying, well, you went to see the firemen and you haven't actually come and spoken to residents, where Jeremy Corbyn did absolutely the opposite. He was there with the cameras and everything, making sure that everyone knew that they could bring any concerns up to him personally. So do you think this is a bit of a blunder by her?
Yeah, I'm not going to defend Theresa May on this one. I think apparently she received advice for security. I mean, I think she was wrong. I think she should have gone to meet people. I know she went to the hospital today, but I think she made a mistake there. I think she should have gone to see people. I know tempers are running high. Was it Mayor Khan, I think, got a bottle thrown at him and things, but I think she should have done it, and I think it was a blunder, quite frankly.
Vary, it does seem as if they're talking about the May bot, aren't they? That Theresa May isn't really in touch. She's okay with the script, but when it actually comes to being touchy-feely, she's just not able to do it.
I mean, this is what we saw throughout the general election as well. No actual meeting with the public, secret visits, set up conversations, and it is unfortunate that she didn't feel at the time able to actually go out and meet with the people who had just gone through this tragedy.
Martin, some people live around that area. It's actually a great part of London, isn't it? Ladbroke Grove, Latimer Road, where you've got actually quite a lot of very wealthy people living very closely, and actually with quite good relations to a large extent with people who are much, much poorer. But those people are saying what's effectively happening here in all sorts of ways is a kind of ethnic cleansing. The poor are being squeezed out of the city.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, the fact that you've got a big social housing block where it is a legacy of post-war planning in London, because that was the idea back in the day, that we were going to have mixed communities, particularly in big cities, where wealthy people would live cheek by jowl with relatively poor people, and they'd share the same facilities, tube stations, etc. I mean, I used to live in Fulham, and that was very definitely the case. There's some very poor people and some very rich people living next door to each other. But of course, if you get rid of all that planning, you gradually, it's a problem everywhere that poorer people are being forced out of the major cities.
I need to make a clarification, because when I make a mistake, I put my hands up on this. Earlier on, I said the housing revenue account had not been cut. I think it's been cut by 1% a year, because it's paid for by rents, and government legislation says rents have got to drop 1% a year. So it has gone down 1% a year, just to clarify.
Yes.
What about the number of council tenants in Bristol? Do either of you know those figures? Because I think we've got
27,000, yeah.
Am I right in thinking Bristol's got more council tenants than anywhere else, pretty much?
I would disagree with that. Yeah, no, because we've also got a significant social housing sector.
Yeah, because
as well,
the thing is, a lot of places have sold off their housing stock, haven't they?
Yeah,
a lot of local authorities.
It depends what you compare us to. I mean, if you're Bristol, sort of sits in a lot of countryside, so yes, we probably have more than neighbouring authorities. If you compare us to core cities like Birmingham or Liverpool, I'd say we probably have a lower percentage. We have a very active housing association market in Bristol that on the whole do a pretty good job. They're not perfect, but they do a pretty good job. So no, I wouldn't quite go with that one.
Okay, well, let's move on to talk about some of the other stories this week. I suppose major is the Queen's speech. What's happening, Mark? Are we going to have a Queen's speech on Monday?
Oh, sorry, I was waiting for my bat phone to phone with you. No, it's Wednesday, I think. The Queen's speech is Wednesday.
What about this deal with the DUP? Are you happy about that? Because Sinn Féin are saying, as they would, that this is breaking the Good Friday Agreement. Now, is it breaking it?
No, it's breaking if they come into government. I think they're talking about supplying confidence, so There won't be any DUP government ministers or anything
so
like that.
So that's why they haven't got a coalition agreement. There will be an agreement on
supply and confidence. So they'll back the budget, they'll back the Queen's speech. I haven't seen the detail yet. It's not out.
What pounds of flesh do you think the DUP will be extracting from Theresa May for this deal? Because she desperately needs the DUP, doesn't she?
I'll come back to that in a second. The joke in 2015, when they interviewed a DUP member of parliament, said, "How much would it take for you to support either a Labour or a Conservative minority government? What would you be looking for?" And he went, "About £1 billion." Just straight out. I don't think it'll be like that. I mean, from the DUP's point of view, they really don't like Labour at all, because Jeremy Corbyn is as pro Sinn Féin, should we say, as you can guess.
So the divide is still there.
The divide is very much still there. So I think there'll be a price. I don't know what that will be. But also, because you've got complexities of the Barnett formula as well. So you can't just hand out money to Northern Ireland. You have to reflect that in Wales and Scotland as well.
Well, the coalition agreement was published between the Lib Dems and the Tories. This one, it may not be published. We may never know.
No, I'm pretty sure you'll see something, but it's not been done yet. Okay. I would imagine the pressure to publish it will be so immense.
Why is Theresa May still Prime Minister? Surely she's just completely blown her credibility by having an unnecessary general election and shot herself in the foot, as I think, was it Gary Hopkins said last week, machine gunned her leg off rather than shot herself in the foot.
Oh, Gary's always such a balanced...
What happened to the days when Prime Ministers and our political leaders had to have some sort of credibility? Because she doesn't have any now.
Yeah, well, no, I mean... I actually supported the calling of an early general election. I thought it would strengthen our hand. I think the manifesto launch is where our campaign went off the rails. I don't think there's any secret on that one. It's not the result we wanted, should we say that? I think that's being generous at this point, considering I just got my head handed to me in Bristol South, so I probably can't say that. It's not great. The thing, though, from she's still there, I would say, and she still needs to be there, because we have Brexit to get on with.
She wasn't elected.
Well,
was she? She was never elected by the Conservative Party. Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword one weekend, and Theresa May suddenly magicked her way into Downing Street.
We have our rules on leadership selection. She won that. I think she'd have won the popular vote against Andrea Leadsom as well in our membership. So,
but why didn't you allow the Conservative Party to do that?
Isn't this? Before the election, people were attacking her for not seeking a mandate from the public. She went to try and get a mandate from the public, and now people are attacking her for actually... she got more votes and seats than anyone else, but she didn't get the outright majority.
So why is she still Prime Minister? Why don't you just have a proper leadership election where the membership of the party
Brexit
decides who's in charge?
Monday.
Too late then, is it?
Time.
Okay.
We have to, whether you like it or not, I mean, the clock is now ticking. We're on a 2-year rundown on Article 50, and we are going to leave the EU. We can't afford to waste another 3 months while the Conservative Party, which I'm obviously a member, while the Conservative Party has a leadership selection. There isn't time. We have to get on with this.
Vari, do you feel like the Labour Party's had too many leadership elections where the Conservatives haven't?
I suspect there won't be one this year.
Yeah, no, I think what is fantastic, actually, over the last few weeks almost, I mean, I can't even really say months, given how short-term that election was.
Yeah.
It's been great, actually, how strong Jeremy Corbyn has been. Our manifesto, obviously, was incredibly popular, and his approval ratings have obviously gone up, and many of his critics have themselves
eaten humble pie
and come out and said actually he did an incredible job. And whilst his approval rating's going up, obviously Theresa May's has dropped, I think, 34 points, gone down fairly quick, a lot lower than the parties. So it's very interesting. I think this DUP deal as well, I mean, I'm a female Scottish Irish Catholic, so from my perspective, with lots of LGBT friends, from that perspective, I'm incredibly concerned.
Who are the DUP?
Who are they? I think that's a question a lot of people in England are asking themselves at the moment. Obviously, from our perspective, obviously they're loyalists. They're very pro the UK.
But hang on a second, because they're called the Democratic and Unionist Party. Now,
yeah.
I mean, anyone that knows what's going on in Northern Irish politics knows that the Unionists tend to be more moderate, and the loyalists more extreme. The loyalists aligning themselves with the paramilitaries.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think
I
think the concerns are, of course, is their links, particularly terrorist links. Which, what's been quite funny actually was a lot of the press and a lot of the messages coming out, obviously talking about Jeremy Corbyn and having links with terrorists, and then of course we've got this deal going forward. And I think the other thing, I think the best quote that I heard was Rob Witherspoon from the CWU said that they obviously called Jeremy Corbyn a dinosaur, and now you're trying to make a deal with people who don't believe dinosaurs existed, which is incredibly okay. Ironic. It's incredibly ironic.
The DUP's okay,
Martin Summers, what do you make of this deal with the DUP?
Well, I think it's interesting because the DUP are not the DUP of old. They have evolved over the last few years. So, for example, one of the top things on their list is to keep the Irish border a soft border. Yeah. Now, that means probably we'll have to go for a soft Brexit. Well, that's possibly the implication of this. Mm. And, of course, some people in the Tory party don't want a soft
that's
Brexit.
What you want,
so,
Mark.
Well, I'm just saying that's one of the problems.
A hard border on the Irish border.
And also, of course, on other matters, they're not really pro-austerity. So various things have been dropped.
Well, hence the billions of pounds, which now look like they'll be going to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and of course, from their point of view, I think Sinn Féin and DUP, although they're obviously historic enemies, have dealt with each other pretty thoroughly over the last few years. And I think that, you know, nobody's going to do anything silly. We're just going to have to see how this plays out. It's a very weak government.
So, Mark,
it takes a couple of by-elections.
Mark, what's happening with Brexit? Can you just clarify what's happening with Brexit now? With
it starts 11 o'clock on Monday morning.
Is it going? What about the basic things like control over immigration? Are we in or out of the single market?
We'll be out. I mean, actually, Jeremy Corbyn and McDonnell from the Labour Party have all confirmed we'll be out of the single market. I mean, the problem is you can't remain a member of the single market and control immigration and. We said we want to withdraw from the jurisdiction of the European Court. Now, that means you're out of the single market. Now, this does raise questions about the Irish border, because you want a soft border. I suspect, and no one wants a manned border at all. You know, you don't want paratroopers there with guns and everything else. I think you're going to have...
That's back to the pre-Troubles.
Well, yeah, things have moved on now. You have an awful lot of electronic kind of borders. I think you can do a lot of customs duties online. You can do a lot with surveillance. I certainly do not want to see a hard border, but I don't think there will be, actually. Whether it's a hard or soft Brexit, I don't think there'll be a hard border.
I used to cycle through that border when I lived over there, which was a really weird experience. You get a kind of big traffic light, you've got about half a mile to cycle into this army base, into this kind of square where you've got a big brick wall either side of you, and you get a loudspeaker asking you who you are, where you're going. Yeah, we don't really want that kind of thing to come back.
I don't think that will happen, and actually Ireland's immigration policy is very much matched to Britain's at the moment. That'll obviously change Brexit, but I don't see Ireland becoming a back door, as it were, which is obviously what the Daily Mail will probably start finding stories of and everything else. Because in order to get from Northern Ireland to the rest of the UK, you have to actually board a plane or board a boat, so you need a passport each time. So I think Northern Ireland will be fine, but we have to get this deal sorted out. I mean, we're not going to know anything really probably for about another 18 months.
Okay, also, Western Hospital A&E is going to be closing overnight as of this week. And we're told that you have to go down to Taunton if you get sick at night. This isn't maybe Vara. You can just tell us about this, because there is a massive gap now in west of Somerset around the Western area. So you're going to have to either come up to Bristol, go across to Bath, or down to Taunton. It doesn't sound like the National Health Service is really doing its job down there.
No, it's incredibly worrying, and actually it's a sort of conversation I've been having over the last, 5 to 6 weeks during the election, was around the funding of the NHS, access to A&E, access to minor injury clinics. It's incredibly worrying for people in that area that they're going to have to travel incredibly far, and the impact that could have, particularly if there's any serious accidents, the response and the ability to be able to get those people to hospital could result in, a really serious incident.
I mean, you can imagine what it's going to be like, Mark, can't you? With when it opens at 8 a.m. in the morning, so it's going to be closed. It's now closed 8 till 8, I believe. Mm. That you end up with a queue of people who've maybe got there at 5, 6 in the morning and are just waiting for accident and emergency to open in Weston.
Yeah, no, I would agree. The weird thing on this one, it seems to be the inability to recruit clinicians. I mean, that seems to be the problem.
Maybe pay.
Possibly, I don't know conditions. This is something outside of Bristol. I'm afraid I'm not the expert on it. But it seems it's certainly not ideal. I hope they can fix it properly. I know the Quality Care Commission came in and said that improvements need to be made, but it seems strange that we can't get the doctors.
There's a huge recruitment crisis actually within the NHS. I mean, I was speaking to a GP about 3.5 weeks ago, and she was telling me that pretty much every practice has at least one vacancy. Which, when we're talking about waiting lists, increasing waiting lists just to see your GP, one of the reasons is because we don't actually have enough GPs. And this is where immigration, this is where the EU particularly, we really need to be thinking about how we retain these staff and how we actually encourage more people, as well as a long term vision.
Martin, sounds like the NHS beginning to creak and groan at the seams. This one particular bit is down on its knees now at Weston.
Well, obviously that's been a major issue of the election campaign, as Vari's just pointed out. I think what's happened is people are sick of the whole concept of austerity, and what they want is the stuff they want. And I think the political parties have now got to come up with that stuff for people, and the money's got to be found. I think that's the big change. You know, if taxes have to rise to pay for it, I think people are ready to demand that.
Do you think there's been a shift over austerity, Mark?
I don't know. Certainly, you could say that the drive in Labour's vote share, because it did go up, would indicate that. I'm going to go a little maverick here, a little rogue. So a little Sarah Palin-like, which is, I don't ever like that analogy at all. I kind of like Norman Lamb's approach when he says, actually, there should be a Royal Commission into this. Because the NHS, I think we've got some pretty hard searching to do on how we pay for it, how it operates, what we can afford for it to do, and need some suggestions on solutions. I hate to say this, well, but I'd almost take a copy from his book.
Sounds like a good idea. Martin, can you give us a 30-second Royal Commission report on how to fix the economy?
Well, I think, but that's a very big demand. But I mean, the fact is that everybody's realised that, yes, we want to get the deficit down, but it's not the priority.
You've got a minute. How do we fix the economy?
Well, we've got to give up being obsessed with the deficit. We should have given it up years ago.
I haven't heard anything about the deficit.
No, well, that's right. It's died the death. So now we're getting back to normal politics, where different political parties are offering the electorate different things.
And we get further and further into unpayable debt.
Well, no, you don't. You have to cut the deficit, but there's no way you can cut it in one go. We were told it was all going to be cut in one parliament. That hasn't happened, for obvious reasons, because it can't be done. And, of course, Labour was saying it couldn't be done in one
Canada
parliament.
Canada did do it, but they took swinging cuts in years.
Well, exactly. So, in other words, they've got a housing bubble crash to come, as we have.
That's so jolly in the evening.
I know, right? I mean, it's not easy to be jolly,
come
is
on,
it?
Martin, you've got enough 30 seconds left to fix
well,
it.
I'm just saying that we've got to give up the idea that by cutting government expenditure, you solve your problems. Not by not cutting government expenditure, you don't solve your problems either. But in actual fact, we're now getting into the real territory of what are we going to do once we've given up the deficit fetish.
What are we going to do?
Well, we're going to invest for the future, and I think that's what Philip Hammond would like to do if he's allowed to do it. We're going to have an industrial policy. Hooray! We've only had 40 years without one, but we're going to have one.
Vari,
what's going to be in it?
Vari,
I don't know.
What do you think? Are there any sort of basic changes in tack that we should be taking right now?
I think the issue is that while you've seen cuts to local government, cuts to NHS, cuts to education, you've also seen cuts to corporation tax. And obviously one of the powerful things that we were saying during the election was that we would look at actually reversing those cuts to corporation tax, and also looking at how we tax the highest earners. And the majority of highest earners that I know, I mean, obviously I live in probably a bit of a bubble.
Do you know?
I don't know a huge amount either. But they were very happy with the idea that actually by paying a small amount more, they would be helping other people. And I think this is that we can't look so narrowly as individualism. We have to look at society. And that's my ideology. And that's, you know, the reason I'm standing. And I think you've got a different ideology to me. But,
so, Mark, what's your ideology? And is Theresa going to do it?
Well, I think the priority of the next government for the next few years will be Brexit. I mean, everyone knows that. But I believe in low taxation. I think that drives economic growth, and I think you actually then tax people a bit less, but you tax a wider base. I think we know when the corporation tax was 26%. We know it brought in about $44.5 billion. We know now it brings in about $50 billion. So I'm afraid I would actually argue that by having a lower tax rate, you can tax more because you get a better investment.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Mark West, and also Labour Councillor for Eastville, Vari Threlfall. After the Murdoch News, 50 years since the Six-Day War and 100 years since the Balfour Declaration. On your mobile.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.